This is an Equity Bates Media podcast.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Have a listen to this. Have a listen to this.
Now, that kind of talk this week dragged Australia's share market to
this
a two-year low.
There are, of course, complex reasons for that.
He was the big spender. Right. The big spender.
Doing the grocery shopping can take a huge chunk out of the family budget.
And that's finance.
Hello and welcome to Comedian versus Economist. We demystify the world of money and help you get a handle on the bigger picture. My name's Adam, and we're joined as always by my little older brother and real life economist, Thomas. Hi, Thomas.
Yeah, g'day, Adam. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Quick story. I went to Disney on Ice over the weekend, took the kids to see Disney on Ice. Disney, I think, has always operated in a pretty high inflationary environment, but the prices at Disney on Ice, we're talking $45 for a stuffed toy. And $25 for a box of popcorn. $25,
what?
Thomas.
Oh, wow.
They were serving shaved ice in little plastic cups for $25. It was,
what? Wow.
It was out of control. And I saw families just like walking out with like the program, right? The program, you know, the brochure, the pamphlet that you get, $25.
Mm. Wow.
20. Oh, it's like that was their minimum. That was their floor price on everything was $25. Man, so yeah, that's how I'm doing. Anyway, welcome to the show if you're joining us for the first time. Maybe a friend sent you, and that's what we're asking you at the moment is if you could spread the word about CVE, tell one person that you know. If you did that, that would be amazing. If everyone told one person, that would really help us out. And also, don't forget FinFest, Thomas, happening October 15th. First release tickets are on sale now for just $47. And Thomas, I think this is going to be like, you know, the very first big day out when Nirvana played and everyone talked about being there. This is going to be it, the same thing for finance. So, you know, you want to be the one who can say, I was there and I saw Thomas stage dive off the top of an inflatable GDP chart into a pit of inflation data. That's what you want to be. So you don't want to miss out. It's going to be epic. First release tickets, as I say, $47. Spots are limited. FinFest is powered by Stake. And before we get stuck into the show, Thomas, I know we're getting sidetracked a bit here, but a bit of housekeeping I wanted to get to. I'm pleased to report that Seth Green, who we covered 2 weeks ago, who had his Bored Ape NFT stolen through a phishing attack, he's now recovered the Bored Ape NFT. He did so with some pretty slick negotiating and $300,000 that he paid to someone called Mr. Cheese. So Seth's got his NFT back. He can now make his show White Horse Tavern. I don't know what the lesson is here. I have no idea how to interpret this. Maybe that cybercrime really does pay. I don't know. It did occur to me that maybe this was just like a genius marketing stunt. Like, this has got all the hallmarks because it went viral and everyone was talking about it. And his show, which probably wouldn't have got big, I don't know, maybe people might have had trouble finding it. So I don't know. Anyway, good news.
I think we would have covered it on Comedian vs. Economist regardless.
So. Yeah, it had all the pop culture stuff we normally get into on this show. All right, speaking of shows, we do have a big show coming up, so let's get into it. Transurban is finally stepping out from Big Brother Keith's shadow and looks set to become a household name as well, raking in millions of taxpayer dollars. Find out what's going on there. Great Britain set to trial the four-day working week. This was following a successful trial last year during the Ashes Tour of Australia, where players didn't work for any more than 4 days at a time. And Thomas, a bit later, the Thailand government has taken a different approach to the war on drugs. They've gone the other way and are offering free drugs to everyone. So we'll see what's going on there. But first, the RBA has upcycled rates again last week by 50 basis points. Thomas, what have they made this time?
Yeah, no, we got a double rate hike last week. They blindsided economists. That's where the headline the AFR was going.
That's
with.
The headline from the economists who don't like to be wrong on these things and are consistently wrong in my experience. Blindsided.
We're just the victims here, casually driving along in our little red car and bam.
Whoa, rates came out of nowhere.
Yeah. So we got 50 bips, takes us up to 0.85. Now, still a very low number worth remembering, but on the way up, the largest increase in 22 years. Haven't seen 50 bips since.
That's cool economist slang for basis points, is it? Bips.
Bips, yeah, bips. Yeah. Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, we've got the lingo. the rates are rising. You know, you take the last two hikes now in May and June on a median mortgage of $750,000, you're adding like $300 a month to mortgage repayments. And we're probably going up further from here. So you're starting to eat into people's budgets and have a bit,
of an effect. Rates are historically very low, but it doesn't really matter. Like, it's all about your starting point. If you got into the market and then rates are rising, then you only know one sort of, one way. So even though they're still low rates, comparatively, they're going up, and that's going to hurt people's hip pockets, as they say.
So we got a big number, that 50 bips. BetterShares chief economist David Bassanese says it's was RBA's attempt to inflict shock and awe on the economy.
In case cool lingo wasn't enough for you, we've got shock and awe from the economic community. This is it.
Shock and awe, yeah. So he's eliminating any lingering complacency with regard to the inflation outlook. So there's a sort of an interesting almost mind game here, is that the RBA is trying to manage expectations because there's a free kick that they can get if they can convince everyone that rates are going up faster and higher than previously thought. Because if everyone expects rates to go up and go up quickly, they start adjusting their spending patterns in the here and now. So they start cutting back on spending, they start cutting back on investment, and so the economy slows on the basis of expectations, which then means that they don't actually have to deliver on the rate hikes because everyone's already slowed down everyone's already adjusted to the potential of rate hikes.
Right.
Does that make sense? So that's what I think he's saying with talking about the shock and awe. It's just like, bam, here's 50 basis points. Everyone's like, whoa, I need to like readjust my thinking around rate hikes. I need to like trim back some spending. I need to, maybe this isn't a great time to invest. That has that impact more so than if they'd just done 25, 25, 25. The way it got written up in the media was like, oh, wow, the RBA's gone uber hawkish. They're now going to raise rates much higher than we thought, much more quickly than we thought. But it may not be the case. It may just be that the RBA wants us to think that, and we're going to get two oversized rate hikes now, and then they'll step back and take it easy.
It's a classic parenting tactic. They're like, don't make me ask you again. Better not make the RBA ask us again. They got pretty angry last time with their double rate hike. We better all behave and do what they want us to do. Otherwise, who knows? So
the other interesting story in this is that Phil Lowe is saying that he expects inflation to come in higher than previously forecast. I was looking for inflation to peak around 6%. We're already at 5.1%, so it's not much of a jump from there. Then you've had an explosion in energy prices. Everyone knows about, you know, food prices, lettuce prices are through the roof. That's the big story. So, yeah, inflation is clearly going higher. And so we're fighting that with rate hikes. Sort of the interesting thing with this is that when you've got cost push inflation, so remember there's two types of inflation. There's demand, what we call demand pull. So like when there's too much money chasing too few goods, when like demand's really strong and everyone's got money and they're bidding up the price of everything because there's not enough things, and so they're willing to pay more for the things. That the price goes up and you get what's called demand pull inflation. And so when an economy is running hot and everything's going great guns and unemployment's really low and everyone's got lots of money, then you get demand pull inflation. And we do have, we have had some of that demand pull inflation. Mm. The other type is cost push inflation, which is when the cost of your inputs going into your things goes up and then firms have to adjust their prices to maintain their margins.
Right.
And that's, so that's cost push inflation. And we've got that too with, because energy prices are through the roof.
So we've got both at the moment, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Perfect storm.
Yeah.
You can use that if you like at your economics parties.
Yeah.
After shock and awe and bips. Oh, yeah. It's a perfect storm.
Oh, yeah, sure. Like everyone's just accepting that the RBA is going to raise rates because inflation's rising. But when you've got an energy price shock like what we've got now, raising rates doesn't help that. You know, energy prices are set on the global energy market by and large, and raising rates doesn't help you with that story. So if all your inflation's related to cost push inflation, related to like an energy price shock, raising rates doesn't really help that unless your strategy is to smash the remainder of the economy so hard that it balances out the rise in energy prices, which is when you get a then you get kind of stagflation, and that's pretty brutal.
Yeah, I was going to say that that did have a very brutal feel to it, the whole, you know.
This is the way you smash there.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I was just trying to shock and awe you.
I was gripped. Is that the plan, though? Is that what they're going to do, or are they going to, I mean, because energy prices are going through the roof. And, in fact, I heard just today that they're talking about load shedding in Queensland and New South Wales, like we can't keep up with demand for energy.
I think the point here is that the RBA only has one tool, and that interest rate tool.
Philip Lowe.
No, not Philip Lowe. So they've got one tool, which is interest rates, and they go up and down. And that's a really good tool when demand's the problem, because it helps jack up demand or it helps squash demand if that's what you want to do. But when you've got price pressure coming from the supply side, interest rates aren't actually that useful. And that's the scenario that we're looking at, where if this energy shock keeps building and keeps going on, the RBA is still forced to rise to sort of try and crunch demand so much that it offsets the supply shock. But that's kind of an ugly scenario. So that's the risk.
Right. So are we still on track for more rate hikes by the end of the year? I mean, like multiple hikes, or is it a sort of wait and see type affair?
Oh, no, I think, I mean, markets now, like there's pricing in an 80% chance of another 50 bips at the next meeting, and then ending the year somewhere around the twos. That's sort of what seemed to be, yeah, so more on the way. But I'm not sure. I think we'll get another big hike at the next meeting, and then after that, I don't know, I think it's an open question.
Right. Bonanza. It's just another word I threw in. If you want to use it, it's not appropriate in that context, but go for it. All right, Thomas, the New South Wales government is going to be giving Transurban stacks of cash. What's going on there?
Yeah, so the New South Wales government announced last week that they're going to implement a toll rebate scheme. It's going to be in the budget. It's going to go out to half a million drivers going to get up to $750 a year to spend on tolls.
Right.
Yeah, they get a 40% rebate once they spend more than $375 in a single year. Maximum benefit of $750.
What does the average toll cost you? We don't have toll roads in Adelaide, little old sleepy Adelaide.
Yeah.
What does a toll cost you each time you go through it?
Couldn't tell you. $5 to $10. It's pretty. We obviously don't have them here in Mullumbimby. We don't even have traffic lights.
You don't even have roads. Yeah. Well, shoot us an email, cve@equitymates.com. What's your average toll?
Yeah. But that's the other point. Like Sydney has 60% of the nation's toll roads.
Right.
Like they've got 20. Sydney's got 20% of the Australian population, 60% of the toll roads.
This reminds me of the time I got ridiculed in a taxi by a taxi driver in Melbourne who was like laughing at me because we only had one tram in Adelaide. He laughed. You guys got one tram. We've got three now, by the way, Mr. Taxi Driver. Yeah, so take that.
So, yeah, so I mean, the thing about this policy is it sounds good. The government's giving people money to help with the cost of living. It's a cost of living package.
Yeah.
But it's just a voucher to spend at one particular place with one particular business. So effectively, the New South Wales government is giving Transurban a whole bunch of cash via the public. And so, effectively what happened is the New South Wales government is raising money from taxpayers and then giving it to Transurban via road users.
Brilliant. The and am I mistaken in thinking these are the roads the government used to own?
They used to own, that's right, and then they sold them to Transurban. Because that's going to create a better outcome for consumers, apparently.
Well, it did. Look, it's already pushing the price of toll down through rebates.
Rebates, yeah. Yeah. So Rod Sibbs, who was the head of the ACCC last year, came out and said it's kind of saying like New South Wales government has gone out and created a monopoly because not only have they sold off the roads, which were public assets that they then put in private hands and then those private hands put tolls on them, but not only that, they sold all of them to Transurban. So they didn't even create competition in the market. They just sold them all to Transurban and just created a monopoly. And then the monopoly's like, well, like all monopolies do, it's like, well, we'll just charge whatever we want. And if it gets to now you've created this moral hazard scenario where Transurban goes, so what happens if we charge people too much and it's just unfair and people complain about it? Ah, the government's going to give the people money to give to us. Can't lose. Great outcome for Transurban.
How does this happen? How do we get here? Because this seems like, I'm not an economist, I'm not a town planner, but this seems like this would have been a fairly easy thing to identify as coming down the road, pardon the pun. But
yeah. No, a lot of people did and it happened anyway.
Good.
Yeah. I mean,
Where's that federal ICAC proposal, by the way?
Yeah. I mean, I think Transurban's just playing the game. I don't think there's any corruption here. But it's just...
Of course not. Let us make it clear on this show right now, Thomas. We are not suggesting for a minute there's been any kind of backroom deals or anything that's led to this cluster of a situation. Not for a second.
But yeah, it's sort of gone out of fashion. It was a bit of a thing, privatization, like the idea of create better outcome for consumers. But with public assets, it almost exclusively hasn't. Like kind of the different, like Productivity Commission and different agencies now are reviewing it and kind of going like, yeah, that was a bit of a fad in the early 2000s and just didn't deliver. Because you're not talking about a competitive market. When you're talking about a particular road, there aren't really that many alternatives to that road unless you're willing to drive well out of out of the thing. So you sort of like, it's a natural monopoly. And I think there is an argument that if you've got a natural monopoly, then the government should own it. Or at the very least, if they own it, they shouldn't sell it off and pass that monopoly on to someone else because you get a ridiculous situation like this. Mm. So it's really terrible policy. And I mean, and the interesting parallel right now is we're talking about this with the energy market. So energy prices are through the roof. And so they're talking about giving consumers cost of living relief with grants and one-off payments and different things. But that money just goes straight into the pockets of the companies who are charging super high prices.
But in the energy market, at least, there's a regulator, isn't there? So...
Well, to an extent, yeah. But I haven't seen a lot of teeth out of that regulator yet. No, and then it's not in the wholesale market as well. So it's like they regulate, like it holds the retail, like it seems to be to me, is they hold the retailers in check, but they're not holding the wholesalers in check. So the retailers are going out of business. It's why they're going broke, is because their wholesale costs are exploding, but they can't pass it on because they're regulated. So that's a sort of terrible outcome. In my mind, like with the energy crisis, the idea of just giving people lots of money is the worst possible use of government money because you're raising money from taxpayers and giving it directly to private corporations, charging war profiteering prices. Mm. So not a great outcome.
Could we as a community maybe get together and build some new roads? around the existing toll. Around we could maybe build a bridge over
No, there's exclusivity clauses. So when when Transurban buys these roads off the government, there's a clause that says you're not allowed to build any roads that might compete with this road.
What?
Yeah, it's pretty dodgy.
As I said before, nothing to see here. Move along if you can afford it. All right, let's pause. We'll grab a quick word from this week's sponsor and we'll be back with more Comedian versus Economist, where we're going to be talking about the four-day work week in Great Britain as well as the Thailand government is going to give away some drugs. Back with more right after this.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back. You're on Comedian versus Economist. You can send us an email if you like, cve@equitymates.com, or check us out on social media on Facebook and Instagram at CVE Podcast. Thomas, the four-day work week's been talked about for a while. Great Britain are now on board. What's going on?
Yeah, well, not quite on board, but they're running a trial. So there's a not-for-profit group called 4-Day Week Global and 4-Day Week UK. Mm-hmm. They've organised a trial, an experiment, where they've sort of tapped a whole bunch of businesses covering 3,300 workers, banks, marketing, healthcare, financial services, retail, even got a fish and chip shop involved.
Fish and chip shop.
Mm.
Fish don't take time off, Thomas. Neither should we. How can you have you can't have a fish and chip shop open 4 days a week, surely?
Well, no. The staff are doing 4 day work weeks. I think you just adjust your rosters.
On a rotation.
It's a restaurant. The restaurant. They're probably open 7 days.
Right.
I guess. Yeah.
That makes more sense.
So 3,300 workers. It's the largest trial of its kind anywhere in the world. Yeah, running for 6 months. So, yeah, people just work 4 days instead of five for the same amount of pay. And they're tracking it, seeing how it goes.
Who's paying? Like, are the businesses on board to pay, or is this a government, is this a Transurban style rebate system?
Yeah, the article didn't say it. I'm wondering.
Because if I was an employer, I'm there paying my staff 5 days a week, paying them for 5 days, getting 5 days a week, and the government come and go, hey, we want to run a trial where all of your staff are going to work 1 day a week less, but you get to keep paying them the same. I'd be like, I know Gary's fish and chip shop's on board, but I'm going to sit this one out.
Yeah. I wonder if there's some kind of a subsidy to the employers. One of the things that seems to emerge with 4 day work week trials is the productivity goes up, and you get just as much out of your employees as you did previously.
Right.
The idea is that they're just happier and they're just enjoying life more. And
just because they're getting paid the same for 4 days a week.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't know. If I have a day off, typically nothing gets done in that day, like of my regular work, obviously, but it's there that the next day I go back to the office. Like, it's there when I go back in. So I'm not, I don't know. I feel like no one, like, if, unless there's someone going to cut, like, it just piles up, and gradually it piles up and up and up, and you've got to, you've got to do the work at some point.
Yeah.
Or things will get done slower.
Yeah.
Even worse is when, like, I don't know, you have people are on flexible working arrangements and you're like, oh, I need Gary to sign this release form for this thing or whatever. It's like, oh, Gary doesn't work on Thursday afternoons. You're like, ah. Now I've got to wait till tomorrow, and then someone else is not there on Friday. Like, sometimes something that should take half an hour to get done. I think you need really good systems in place to make sure that there's redundancy and whatever within the work practices.
Yeah.
You've got someone on the fryer, someone else on the chippery.
I mean, I work for myself, and so like I noticed that like I'm incentivized to for each task that I do to be as quick as possible because I'm not on the clock. So like I have a real incentive for things to get quicker, and I get quicker and quicker every year because I'm driven by that incentive.
You don't have meetings.
Yes, though. It's funny you should say that because that's what they noticed, that the first thing that these businesses cut. When they go to four-day work weeks, they just have less meetings.
I think it was a university. Someone made a meeting cost calculator where you just punched in the number of participants in a meeting, the average salary per participant, and it just gave you the cost of the meeting, and it was like it's just eye-watering.
Yeah, right.
You know, people are like, I'm just going to call a meeting and I'm going to mark these 15 people as optional, and all of the 15 optionals all showed up, and there's like the 10 people who were invited, and before you know it, you got yourself a $25,000 meeting. Like, So, it could be good for business too, I guess, in that sense.
It's like nuclear disarmament in a way. Like you're trying to create some mechanism that stops people working really long hours, because kind of what happens is when everyone works more, you get this rat race effect. In order to keep up, you've got to sort of keep everyone's going faster and faster. And if someone goes a little bit faster, that then changes the bar and then everyone else has to catch up. And so you sort of had this with like, you know, like they talk about in the 1920s, like John Maynard Keynes, the most famous economist ever, he was talking about...
I've got a poster of him on the wall here.
It's upside down. Yeah, but he was saying in the 1920s, it's like, I can't imagine what people are going to do with all their time in 100 years. And in 100 years, and technology has surprised to the upside. It would like totally obliterated his expectations of what technology could achieve. But for all that, we're still working longer than our grandparents did. The capitalist system that we've got isn't good at generating leisure. It's good at sort of charging on and creating growth and, you know, lifting people out of poverty. I think it's got a good track record of that. But generating leisure, which is kind of like where we're at in society now. Like I think like that's what we want. You could launch a leisure party, like a political party that says we're just about making sure that everyone has enough leisure and trying to create this disarmament where everyone steps back and it's like no one's showing up to the office and putting in the 12-hour work days to sort of get ahead, and no one's working 6-day work weeks to get ahead. We're just trying to disarm that and walk it back. And so the 4-day work week's the first sort of attempt at that.
That's not in alignment with businesses trying to win, right? Like businesses are trying to make more money. They're trying to beat out the competition. We talk about having a moat, competitive edge, and all that sort of stuff. And so presumably one of the ways to do that, or historically one of the ways to do that, is to be better and faster and smarter and just generally all around like more awesome than the next company. And that's how your company gets ahead. And in order to do that, then you need all the people to drive it and kind of make it happen. If you start going, well, we're going to give all of our people some extra time off, at a company level, you run the risk of falling behind.
Yeah, that's why it needs to be an agreement. It needs to be like a disarmament process. It needs to be everyone in society at the same time stepping down and ratcheting it down. Yeah, because it's like there's in game theory, you talk about a prisoner's dilemma. It's something like that, where it's like there's an incentive in the system to cheat. Like if we all said, okay, everyone, we're gonna move to a 4-day work week, and one company went, I'm actually gonna work my staff 6 days a week, they've got an advantage and they get ahead, and everyone else looks at them and goes, hey, they're getting ahead because they're doing that, and then boom, we ratchet back up again. So you need mechanisms that create a collective agreement and then hold to that agreement.
So who's driving this then? Is this the government driving it, or this is a
not-for-profit 4-day work week global. I love the idea of it, because we could, in my mind, everyone drop a day of work a week. And the relativities wouldn't change. We'd all be in exactly the same place. We'd have exactly the same amount of money. We'd have exactly the same amount of staff. But we would just have an extra day of leisure a week.
And we get paid overtime on Fridays now. All right, Thomas, finally, I can't believe this is true, but the Thailand government is giving out free drugs. That can't be right. What's going on?
It's not far off the mark. Yeah, they're going to distribute one cannabis plant to every household in Thailand. Yeah.
What?
So they're low THC plants, so for medicinal purposes only. So, yeah, so the THC needs to be below 0.2%. So that's actually pretty low, like, I don't think you're going to get very high on 0.2%. Like, you know, like in California, yeah, like where it's legalized now, like most dispensaries are serving something around 20%. So it's well below that threshold. So you'd have to smoke a lot to get pretty high, I'm guessing.
People will
give it a crack.
Don't you worry. If the Australian government started sending marijuana plants to every one of its citizens, you can guarantee there's some people who are going to see how many it takes to get a buzz. Interesting move by the government. I mean, they're facing the same economic pressures as everyone else, I guess. This is actually part of their Grow Weed, Not Wages campaign. Right.
They're trying to sort of position Thailand as a sort of health and wellness destination and sort of like get that sort of wellness tourism. And so, yeah, they've removed cannabis from its list of illegal narcotics. It's first Southeast Asian country to legalize medical cannabis in 2018. Yeah, right. Decriminalized it in January 2022. That said, if you're caught smoking anything with higher than 0.2%, you get 15 years jail. So
that's still a thing.
Pretty hard on the other
but
side.
But still, you've got it. You're essentially, as the government now, that you're saying, like, it's okay for everyone to have, like, a cannabis plant at their house. Well, we gave it to them, so we can't then go and start arresting people. So then there's for them to go and test, you know, everyone's plants all the time for the THC levels, that would be a huge burden. So it's very much a shift towards, like, being more accepting of marijuana in society.
I think so, yeah.
Do you think this will help the government's image? Like, do you think people see the government giving everyone a free plant, just be like, we got a cool government.
Government's cool.
Maybe it'll just help, like, in the short term, but then when people go back for their second and third plants and the government's like, look, it's $1,000 a plant now. But I haven't got $1,000. Do you want your drugs or not?
I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. Like, I don't quite get what giving it to households really helps you achieve. Like, they're trying to build their medical cannabis industry. Like, a lot of nations are doing that. Like, maybe there's value if households have it, that you get sort of more innovation happening and you get more products happening, or just
creative thinking.
Creative thinking.
Well, maybe it's something for the New South Wales government to consider. Instead of toll road subsidies, just hand out a free plant. People might not need to travel as much. I think the timing of this is terrible, though.
Why is that?
There's a global food crisis, Thomas. The last thing we need is government sponsored munchies.
An entire nation looking for their chicken and rice.
There's a chicken shortage too. Yeah. This has got trouble written all over it. All right, I think we've got ourselves probably in enough trouble this week. So if you're a lawyer representing Phil Lowe, Transurban or the Thailand government, then please direct all correspondence to cve@equitymates.com. And don't forget to check out all the other great podcasts from Equity Mates Media. Equity Mates Get Started Investing, Equity Mates Investing Podcast, You're in Good Company, Talk Money to Me, Crypto Curious, The Dive, and don't forget FinFest happening October 15th. Head to equitymates.com/FinFest for your tickets now. Thanks to you, Thomas.
Thank you.
We will see you all again next week. Look forward to talking to you then. Bye for now.
Comedian vs. Economist is a product of Equity Mates Media. All information in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional finance, legal, or tax advice. The hosts of Comedian vs. Economist are not financial professionals and are not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Before making any financial decisions, you should read the product disclosure statement and, if necessary, consult a licensed financial professional. Do not take financial advice from a podcast. For more information, head to the disclaimer page on the Equity Mates website, where you can find ASIC resources and find a registered financial professional near you. In the spirit of reconciliation, Equity Mates Media and the hosts of Comedian vs Economist acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.